tired of her swearing and her smoke fumes, though it was hard to imagine they were worse than my endless nausea. He leaned back on his elbows against the rail, tipping his head back to look at the boat's squat upper deck.
"Where do we go once we get to Le Havre, miss?"
"Eve says the woman we need to talk to is in Roubaix, so we may as well go there before Limoges. But I was thinking..." I trailed off.
"Thinking what?"
"Rouen first?" It came out as too much of a question, and I kicked myself for that. I didn't have to ask permission for where we went next. This was my quest, though that was far too grandiose a word. My mission? My obsession? Well, whatever you called it, my money was funding everything, so I was the one in charge. Finn and Eve seemed to take that for granted, something I couldn't help but enjoy after so many weeks of feeling like a leaf on the surface of a whirlpool. "We'll go to Rouen," I said firmly. My aunt left Paris and moved to the summer house for good after the war, Rose's mother. She wasn't very forthcoming in her letters, but if I turn up on her doorstep, surely she'll talk to me. I thought of my French aunt with her endless rattling handbag full of pill boxes, for all the illnesses she was convinced she was dying of, and I wanted to seize hold of her bony arms and shake her till she coughed up the answers I wanted. Why did Rose leave home in 43? What happened to your daughter? I looked across the deck and saw the 8-year-old Rose, wiry and freckled, skipping along the rail. She smiled at me, and then I saw she wasn't Rose at all. She didn't even have Rose's blonde hair. I watched the child run back to her mother at the bow, and still my imagination tried to tell me it was Rose's fair plaits bouncing against that narrow back, not a stranger's brown ones. "Rouen," I repeated. "We'll stay the night in Le Havre, then drive in the morning. We could get there tonight if we could take the train." Eve had flatly refused to consider anything but car travel, and so I'd had to fork over a good sum to have Finn's Lagonda lifted ponderously up into the boat by crane. Like we were British lords off for a continental motoring jaunt with a champagne picnic. For what it cost to bring the car, and because of the car we had to take the slower boat to Le Havre rather than Boulogne, I could have ferried 6 people to France and back. "Couldn't that cow buck up and suffer a train ride?" I grumbled.
"I don't ken she could," Finn said.
I glanced at my unpredictable ally at the other end of the deck. On the car journey, she'd been by turns insulting or silent, refusing to get out of the car when we reached Folkestone, and Finn had to escort me to buy tickets for the Channel crossing. When we came back to the Lagonda, she disappeared, and after going up and down in the car, we found her standing outside a shabby row house marked number 8 on the parade. Just standing there, scowling.
"Still wonder where that skinny English boy went," she said, apropos of nothing. "The one booted out of the course. Did he join the boys in the trenches, get himself blown up? Lucky bastard."
"What course?" I asked, exasperated. But she just gave her harsh bark of a laugh and said,
"Haven't we got a boat to catch?"
And now she was sitting in the far corner of the deck in a shabby coat, hatless, smoking an unending chain of cigarettes, and looking unexpectedly fragile. "My brother always sat like that," I said, "with his back in a corner. When he came back from Tarawa, anyway. He got drunk one night and told me he wasn't comfortable anymore, unless he could see all the lines of fire." A lump rose in my throat as I remembered James's broad, handsome face. Not really handsome anymore under the blur of drink and the pasted-on smile, because his eyes were so empty.
"A lot of soldiers do that," Finn said, neutral.
"I know," swallowing down the lump. "It wasn't just my brother. I used to see it when the soldiers came into the coffee shop where I worked." I caught Finn's look of surprise.
"What? You think the rich little American never had a job?"
That was clearly exactly what he'd thought. "My father thought his children should know the value of a dollar. I started working at his office when I was 14. A law firm specializing in international law, French and German heard on the telephone lines as much as English. I'd started out watering the plants and making the coffee, but soon I was filing papers, organizing my father's notes, even balancing his account books once it became clear I could do it faster and more neatly than a secretary. And then when I went to Bennington," I continued, "and my mother wasn't there to forbid me,
I got a job at a coffee shop. That's where I'd see the soldiers come in. Finn looked bemused.
Why work if you didn't have to?
I like being useful. Anything to get me out of white gloves and cotillion. You can watch people in a cafe, make up stories about them. That one over there is a Nazi spy. That one over there is an actress on her way to a Broadway audition. Besides, I'm good with numbers, so I'm useful in a shop. Making change in my head, keeping the register. I was a math major in school. How my mother's brows had furrowed when she'd heard I'd signed up for calculus and algebra at Bennington.
I know you like that sort of thing, ma chérie. I don't know how I'll keep my checkbook balanced with you away in Vermont. But don't make too much of it on dates. Don't do that thing you do, where you add up all the menu prices in your head to see if you can do it faster than the waiter. Boys don't like that sort of thing.
Maybe that was why I'd taken the coffee shop job once I got to Bennington. My small rebellion against the litany I'd heard all my life about what was proper, what was suitable, what boys liked. My mother sent me to college to find a husband, but I was looking for something else. Some other path besides the one picked out for me. Traveling, working, who knew what? I hadn't had it figured out yet. But then the little problem came along and shot my mother's plans and mine all to pieces.
Making change for cups of coffee.
Finn cracked a smile.
That's a bonny way to spend a war.
Not my fault I was too young to be a nurse. I hesitated, but asked anyway. My stomach was rolling, and the conversation helped keep my mind off it. What about your war? Because everyone's war was different. Mine was algebra homework, going on the odd date, and waiting every single day for letters from Rose and James. My parents' war was Victory Gardens and scrap metal drives, and my mother fretting about having to put makeup on her legs instead of stockings. And my poor brother's war. Well, he wouldn't say what it was, but it made him swallow a shotgun. What was your war like? I asked Eve's driver again, blinking James's face away before it made my throat tighten. You said you were in the anti-tank regiment.
I didn't get wounded. Had a bro time of it. Pure dead brilliant.
Finn was mocking something, but I didn't think it was me. I wanted to ask, but his face had closed off, and I couldn't bring myself to pry further. I hardly knew him after all. He was Eve's man of all work, the Scotsman who made breakfast. I didn't know if he liked me at all, or was just being polite. I wanted him to like me. Not just him, Eve too, much as she both baffled and annoyed me. In their company I had a fresh slate. To them I was Charlie St. Clair, spearhead of the world's most unlikely search party. Not Charlie St. Clair, complete disgrace and all-around tramp. Eventually Finn wandered off and my stomach began churning again. I passed the rest of the journey staring at the horizon and swallowing hard. At last the cry went up.
Le Havre!
And I was the first one down to the docks, lugging my traveling case, so glad to be on firm ground that I could have kissed it. It took me a moment to register the scenery around me. Le Havre showed even more signs of the war than London. The harbor had been bombed flat, I remembered. The storm of iron and fire, they called it. There was still so much rubble, so many missing buildings. More than that, there was a general gray dispiritedness here, a tiredness in the crowds around me. The Londoners I'd encountered seemed to carry themselves with a certain grim humor. As if to say, you still can't get cream with your scones, but we never did get invaded, eh? France, despite all the giddiness I'd read about in the papers. General de Gaulle marching down the boulevards of Paris in triumph. The delirious, screaming crowds. Just looked exhausted. By the time Eve and Finn had joined me, I had shoved my sudden melancholy away, and was fingering the wad of francs I'd acquired in Folkestone.
Dear, does your father know you're changing this much money?
Finn deposited Eve and her dilapidated luggage, then moved off swiftly down the dock to make certain the disembarking crane did not dent his precious Lagonda. "We'll need a hotel," I said absently, recounting my francs and staving off a sudden wave of weariness. "Do you know of somewhere cheap?"
"There's no shortage of cheap in a waterfront city."
Eve looked at me in amusement.
"Want a bunk with Finn? Two rooms are cheaper than three."
"No, thank you," I said coldly.
"What prudes Americans are," she chuckled.
We stood in silence until the dark blue Lagonda at last rounded the corner. purring. How did he ever get a car like that? I wondered, thinking of Finn's threadbare shirt.
Probably did something illegal,
Eve said carelessly. I blinked. Are you joking?
No. You think he worked for a bad-tempered bitch like me for fun? Nobody else was about to give him a job.
I probably shouldn't have either, but I have a weakness for good-looking men with Scottish accents and prison terms. I nearly fell off my high heels.
What? Haven't you figured it out?
She cocked an eyebrow.
Finn's an ex-convict.
Chapter 6 Eve June 1915 Marguerite Lefrancois came in out of the rain and sat down in an isolated corner table in a café in Le Havre. A respectable girl, hatted and gloved, timidly asking the waiter in her northern-accented French for a lemonade. If you looked in Marguerite's pocketbook, you would find all her identity cards in immaculate order. She was born in Roubaix. She had work papers. She was 17. Just what else Marguerite was, Eve wasn't sure yet. The identity was filmy, not yet fleshed out with the details that would make it real. When Captain Cameron, Uncle Edward, put Eve on the boat from Folkestone, all he'd given her was the immaculate packet of false papers, a respectable if threadbare travelling suit, and a battered case full of more respectable, threadbare clothes. And a destination.
In Le Havre, he said on the dock. You will meet your contact. She will tell you what you need to know, going forward.
Is she your shining star? Eve couldn't help ask. Your best agent?
Yes.
Cameron had smiled, eyes crinkling at the corners. Out of his immaculate khaki uniform and back to his anonymous tweeds.
I can think of no one better to prepare you.
I will be just as good. Eve held his eyes fiercely. I will make you proud.
You all make me proud, Cameron said. The moment a recruit accepts an assignment, I am proud. Because this isn't just a dangerous job. It's dirty and distasteful. Not very sporting, really, to listen at doors and open a man's mail. Even an enemy's. No one really thinks gentlemen should do such things, even in a time of war. Much less gentlewomen.
Rubbish, Eve said tartly, and Cameron laughed.
Consummate rubbish. Still, the kind of work we do isn't much respected, even among those who rely on our reports. There's no acclaim to be had, no fame, no praise. Just danger.
He tweaked her drab little hat to a better angle over her neatly rolled hair.
So never fear that you have failed to make me proud, Miss Gardner.
Mademoiselle Lefrancois, Eve reminded him.
Quite.
His smile faded then.
Be careful.
Bien sûr. What is her name? This woman in Le Havre, your shining star, who I am going to replace.
Alice,
the captain said in amusement.
Alice Dubois. Not her real name, of course, and if you can best her, you will end the war in 6 months.
He stood for a long time on the dock, watching Eve's boat recede into the choppy surf. She gazed steadily back until the tweedy figure disappeared. She felt a twinge to see him gone, the first person ever to have faith in her, to believe she could be something more, not to mention her last contact with everything left behind. But excitement soon won over loneliness. Eve Gardner had left England. Marguerite Lefrancois had arrived in Le Havre. And she waited, sipping lemonade and concealing a curiosity that could fairly be called ravenous, for the mysterious Alice. The café was crowded. Sour-faced waiters squeezed past with dirty plates and bottles of wine. Customers came in from the street, shaking off their rainy umbrellas. Eve scrutinized every woman in sight. A stout matron with a brisk manner had the heavy anonymity and the competent air of a master organizer of spies. Or perhaps the raw-boned young woman who leaned her bicycle outside and then had to stop in the doorway to clean her spectacles. She might be concealing eyes like a hawk that had read German plans by the dozen.
Ma chère Marguerite,
a woman's voice shrieked, and Eve's head jerked around at the name she'd trained herself like a puppy to respond to. She had the impression of a hat bearing down on her, not just any hat, but a hat the size of a wagon wheel covered with pink organza and silk roses. and then the hat's owner enveloped her in a cloud of Lily of the Valley scent and kissed her soundly on both cheeks.
Chérie, look at you. How is dear Oncle Edouard?
It was the phrase she was told she would hear first, but all Eve could do was stare. This is the organizer of the Lille network. The little Frenchwoman was perhaps 35, bird-boned, hardly up to Eve's chin. She wore a dashing suit in a violent shade of lilac, topped by the mountainous pink hat. Shopping bags piled up around her as she settled, chattering behind the table, switching from rapid French into equally rapid English. In this part of France, English voices were common thanks to soldiers and nurses on leave from the front.
Mon Dieu, this rain! My hat is sure to be ruined. Perhaps it should be ruined. I couldn't decide if it was utterly ghastly or utterly magical. So, of course, there was nothing to do but to buy it.
She extracted a few pearl hat pins and hurled the hat to the spare chair, revealing blonde hair rolled into a pompadour.
I always buy a morally questionable hat whenever I come through this area. I can't take them back north with me, of course. Wear a nice hat, and a German sentry will just confiscate it for his latest whore. So in Lille, I go about in last year's serge and a dismal little boater. And anything fashionable gets abandoned as soon as I return. I must have left morally questionable hats all over France.
Brandy, she said to the waiter, appearing at her elbow, and unleashed a ravishing smile as he reared back.
It's been an absolute pisser of a day, she said frankly. So make it a double brandy, monsieur, and never mind looking sour.
So? She turned back to Eve, sitting silent and rather wide-eyed through this introductory monologue, and looked her up and down, suddenly all business.
Merde. Uncle Edward sends me babies from the cradle now.
I'm 22, Eve said with a touch of frost. No fluffy Parisienne who matched pink with purple was going to make her feel like an infant.
Mademoiselle Dubois, stop right there.
Eve froze, looking around the rickety café. Is someone listening?
No, no, we're safe. If anyone understands English, which I doubt.
We're in the corner of a room too full of noise for anyone to hear a useful word.
No, I meant stop calling me that horrid name.
An extravagant shudder.
Alice Dubois, what sin did I commit to earn a name like that? I shall have to ask my confessor. Alice Dubois sounds like a skinny schoolmistress with a face like a bin. Call me Lily. It's not my real name either, but at least it has some dash. I gave Uncle Edward hell until he started using it too. I think he likes it, because he started giving flower names to the rest of his nieces, like Violette. You'll meet her soon. She'll hate you, but she hates everybody. And now you, Marguerite, the little daisy. We're his garden, and he fusses over us like an old maid with a watering can.
Alice, slash Lily, had been speaking with her head close to Eve's, so their conversation would be inaudible. But she still broke off the instant the waiter approached with her brandy.
Merci,
she beamed, ignoring his disapproving look. Eve had never in her life seen a well-bred woman drink spirits. Except perhaps medicinally, but she kept silent, rotating her glass of lemonade. Captain Cameron warned her against thinking of this work as a game, but his prize agent seemed to consider everything a joke.
Or does she?
Under the breezy chatter, Lily showed an instinctive caution. Her words paused the moment anyone brushed even remotely close to their table. Although her voice was already so low, Eve had to bend confidentially near to catch every word. They looked like two women sharing a cozy secret, which, of course, they were. Lily didn't seem to mind Eve's scrutiny. She scrutinized right back, her deep-set eyes almost liquid in their movement.
22 years old, she repeated. I'd never believe it.
And that's why my papers say I'm 17. Eve opened her eyes to their widest, fanning her lashes in sweet confusion, and Lily gave a laugh of sheer merriment, clapping her hands.
Maybe our mutual uncle is a genius after all. What a morsel you are, chérie. Fresh from the schoolroom and dumb as a daisy. I'd swear it.
Eve lowered her lids demurely.
Most kind. Yes. Uncle Edward said you had a hitching tongue, Lily said frankly. I imagine that's hell in normal life, but it will stand you in good stead now. People talk around women, and they talk even more around girls. And they'll chatter like geese around a girl who seems half-witted. I advise you to play it up like mad. Let's order baguettes. You won't be getting good bread in Lille. All the good white flour goes to the Boche. So whenever I come south, I gorge on good bread and fashionable hats. I love this city. And as Lily slugged back the rest of her brandy and called for baguettes and jam, Eve began to smile. Uncle Edward said you'd have details for me. She was hungrier for information than for bread. You are a straight-to-business sort, aren't you? Lily pecked at the first baguette, eating in darting bites like a neat little bird. You will be going to a restaurant in Lille. Very fashionable. The kind of place where they'd never serve a large brandy to a lady in a morally questionable hat. Lily rattled her empty glass. To have another, we... Oh, no. Oh, we, of course. If one has the luxury of sleeping safe in the night to come, one should always have more brandy. She raised a finger to the waiter 3 tables away, pointing to her snifter, and he looked positively pinched. The restaurant is called Le Lété, she resumed, lowering her voice even further. The German commandant eats there at least twice a week, and half the officers in the region flock after him, considering Le Lété's cooks get half the black market food in Lille. There was a waiter who worked there, clever fellow, used to pass me information. Mon Dieu, the kind of things he overheard when those officers were deep in their schnapps. I wanted someone to put in his place when he was caught, and voila! Uncle Edward tells me he's plucked a perfect little daisy for me. Caught? Eve asked. Stealing supplies. Lily shook her head. He had good ears, but no sense. Stealing chickens and sugar and flour from the people you spy on. Merde, what an idiot. Of course, he was shoved into the nearest back alley and shot. Eve's stomach churned, and she put down her baguette. Shot? How very real it was all becoming. So much more real in this steaming little café than on the sunny beach in Folkestone. Lily gave a one-sided smile. You're feeling sick, I know. It's quite natural. So I'll eat your baguette. You really should try to thin down a bit before we let you go to your interview anyway. You look a bit too healthy to have come from Roubaix. Everyone in the north looks like a rake handle. Look at me, a bag of bones with skin like an ashtray. Eve had already noted the marks of exhaustion under Lily's eyes, and now she saw the pallor of that thin face, despite its smiles. Will I look like that in a few months? Eve wondered, and shoved her baguette over to Lily's plate. Interview, she prompted. For the job at Le Lété. The owner has let it be known he will consider hiring waitresses instead of waiters. Normally he'd faint dead away before allowing a woman to serve in his establishment. But waiters are one thing he can't get on the black market. War makes men harder to find than white flour, even for a damned profiteer like René Bordelon. Who, I should warn you, is a beast. He'd turn his own mother into the Germans for a profit. Not that he has a mother. The devil probably shit him out after a night's drinking with Judas. Lily polished off the last crumbs of his baguette. You'll need to persuade Monsieur Bordelon to hire you. He's clever, so don't go thinking it will be simple. Eve nodded as the identity of Marguerite Lefrancois took firmer shape. A little country girl, wide-eyed, not too bright, not too educated, but deft and quiet and graceful enough to serve bœuf en daube and oysters en brochette, without drawing attention to herself. Once you're hired, if you're hired, you'll pass anything you hear to me. Lily fished in her handbag and pulled out a silver cigarette case. I'll see it gets to Uncle Edward. How? Eve asked, trying not to stare as Lily struck a match. Only common women smoke, Eve's mother had always decreed. But Lily could not be branded common, despite her violent pink hat and her brandy. That's courier business, Lily said vaguely. My job. I can be any number of people and go any number of places, whereas that hitching tongue would get you recognized if you tried. So we'll play to your strengths. Eve didn't bother being offended. It was the truth, after all. She imagined Lily sashaying through armed checkpoints, chattering up a storm, and smiled,
I think your job is more dangerous than mine.
Oh, pff. I manage. With any paper one sticks under their nose, and plenty of self-possession, one can get through. Especially a woman. Sometimes I take an armload of parcels and bags, and drop every single one as I try to find my identity cards, chatting all the while. And they wave me through out of sheer irritation.
Lily exhaled a long stream of smoke.
To tell the truth, much of this special work we do is quite boring. I think that's why women are good at it. Our lives are already boring. We jump at Uncle Edward's offer because we can't stand the thought of working in a file room anymore, or teaching a class full of runny-nosed children their letters. Then we discover this job is deadly dull as well. But at least there's the enlivening thought that someone might put a luger to the back of our necks. It's still better than shooting ourselves, which we know we're going to do if we have to type one more letter or pound one more Latin verb into a child's ivory skull.
Eve wondered if Lily was a schoolmistress before the war. She wondered how Captain Cameron recruited Lily, but she knew no one would tell her. No real names, no backgrounds, not unless necessary.
Uncle Edward says you're his best, she remarked instead.
Lily let out another peal of laughter.
What a romantic that man is. St. George in tweed. I do adore him. Far too honorable for this business.
Eve agreed, prison sentence or no. She kept turning that mystery over in idle moments. Cameron, imprisoned for fraud. But it didn't really make a difference. Whatever his background, she trusted him. And clearly so did Lily.
Come along now.
Lily stubbed out her cigarette.
You should meet Violette Lameron. She calls herself my lieutenant, though if we had proper ranks, I'd be able to scold her, rather than having her constantly scolding me. I think it's because she used to be a nurse, which you need to know, by the way, in case you ever have an injury to be patched up. She might have decided she'd rather be shot than roll another bandage for the Red Cross, but she still knows what to do if she sees broken bones or spurting wounds.
And she'll see you to right if you ever get yourself hurt.
Though you won't enjoy the process. God help me, how that woman can nag.
Affectionately.
The habit of nagging, let me assure you, goes with a nurse no matter what she does.
Lily clapped the massive pink hat back over her blonde hair, collected her packages, and shepherded Eve into the streets of Le Havre. It was warm despite the rain, and rosy-faced mothers herded their children back toward home as cab horses splashed through the puddles. No one here, Eve observed, had Lily's thinness or exhausted, grainy look. And maybe Lily was thinking the same thing, because she unfurled her umbrella with a vicious snap, saying,
I hate this city. You said you loved it.
I love it and I hate it. Le Havre, Paris. I love their baguettes and their hats, but merde. The people have no idea what is happening in the north. None at all.
That mobile face was still for an instant.
Lille is overrun by beasts, and here they sniff if you want a brandy and a smoke to get through a pisser of a day.
Lily, Eve asked impulsively, are you ever afraid? Lily turned, rain dripping off the edge of her umbrella in a silver curtain between her and Eve.
Yes, just like everybody else.
But only after the danger is done. Before that, fear is an indulgence.
She slid her hand through Eve's elbow.
Welcome to the Alice Network.
Chapter 7. Charlie. May 1947. Summertime, almost exactly 10 years ago. I'd been 9 and Rose 11 when our families went on a drive through Provence and ended up leaving us at a roadside cafe for nearly 6 hours. An accident, of course. 2 cars, one with the adults and one trundling behind with the children and the nanny. A stop at a cafe overlooking a vineyard of budding grapes. Our parents looking for lavatories and postcards. Rose and me following the smell of fresh-baked bread to the kitchen. Our brothers roughhousing. And somehow when everyone loaded back up, the nanny thought we climbed into the car with our parents, and our parents thought we were with the nanny, and everyone drove off without us. It was the only time I'd ever seen Rose scared, and I couldn't understand it. We weren't in any danger, The plump and motherly Provençal cook had made a great fuss over us once she discovered what had happened.
Don't worry, mademoiselle. It won't be 20 minutes before your mothers are back.
Soon we were settled at a table of our own under a striped awning overlooking the vineyard, with glasses of cold lemonade and thick sandwiches of goat cheese and prosciutto. They'll be back soon, I said, munching. As far as I was concerned, this was much better than sitting hot and cramped in the Renault's back seat, getting admonished by the nanny and pinched by our brothers. But Rose just stared down the road, not smiling.
Maybe they won't come back, she said. My mother doesn't like me.
Yes, she does.
Not now I'm getting, you know, older.
Rose looked down at herself. Even at 11, she was starting to sprout a bust.
Maman doesn't like it. She feels old.
Because you're going to grow up even prettier than her. I won't grow up pretty enough for mine.
I sighed, but the gloom didn't last long. The day was too beautiful, and the smiling cook had just laid down a plate of piping hot madeleines.
Why is it always about being pretty with us? Rose exclaimed, still glaring over the stunning view of vines and sky. Don't you like being pretty? I wish I were.
Well, of course I like it. But when people meet our brothers, they don't just comment on their looks. They ask, how do you do in school, or do you play football? No one ever does that with us.
Girls don't play football. You know what I mean.
Rose looked stormy.
Our parents would never have left the boys behind. Boys always come first.
So? That was just the way things were. Not something to resent or even think about very much. My parents laughed indulgently whenever James pulled my hair, or dunked me in the stream until I was crying. Boys got to do whatever they wanted, and girls got to sit around looking pretty. I wasn't very pretty, but my parents still seemed to have lofty plans for me. White gloves, a proper school, and becoming a lovely bride someday. Maman had already told me that if I was lucky, I'd be engaged by the time I was 20. Just like her. Rose sat twisting the end of her long braid.
I don't want to just be pretty when I grow up. I want to do something different. Write a book, swim the channel, go on safari and shoot a lion, or just stay here forever.
The smells of wild lavender and rosemary on the summer breeze, the warmth of the sun overhead, the sound of happy French babble from other diners, the goat cheese and crusty bread delicious on my tongue. This little cafe seemed just like heaven as far as I was concerned.
We're not staying here forever.
Rose looked worried again.
Don't say that.
I was just joking. You don't really think they'd leave us here, do you?
No.
I could see her trying to be rational, the big girl of 11 who knew so much more than me. But then she whispered, as if she couldn't help it.
What if they don't come back?
I think I realized then why Rose was such a friend to me. She was 2 years older. She could have brushed me off as a little pest. Yet she always welcomed my tagging along. Sitting in that heavenly cafe, I saw it. Her brothers had their own games. Her mother resented her just a little. Her father was always working. Except for these summers when I came to visit and became her loyal shadow. She was lonely. I was only 9. I couldn't put any of this into words. Or even understand it as well as I did later. But I had some muddled idea, seeing her fight the fear that her parents wouldn't bother coming back for her. And I squeezed her hand.
Even if they don't come back, I'm here, I'd said. I won't leave you.
Miss.
I blinked, coming back from summer of 37 to May of 47. Memory had dragged me down so strongly. It was a shock to look over and see Finn's dark eyes and tousled hair, instead of 11-year-old Rose's blonde plait and baby blues.
"We've arrived," he said. "This is the address you gave me."
I shivered. The car had stopped. I looked out at the gravel drive leading up to the rambling house where I'd spent every summer of my life, up until Germany invaded France. My aunt and uncle's house outside Rouen. Yet somehow I was still seeing that café in Provence, where 2 little girls had spent nearly 6 hours before their parents realized the mistake at the next stop, 3 hours down the road, turned around and raced back. Those 6 hours were magic. Rose and I stuffed with goat cheese and madeleines, playing tag among the grapevines, bundling into aprons to help the friendly cook wash the mugs, feeling very grown up when she allowed us a small glass of watered-down rosé apiece. Sleepily watching the sun come down over the vineyards, heads on each other's shoulders. Feeling a little disappointed to leave, once our frantically worried parents arrived with breathless hugs and apologies. The best day Rose and I ever had. The best day of my life, really. Because of the simplest equation in the world. Rose plus me equaled happiness. I won't leave you, I promised. But I had. And now she was gone.
You all right?
Finn asked. That dark gaze of his didn't miss much. Fine, I said, slipping out of the car. Stay here with Eve. She was dozing in the back seat, the sound of snores rising against the summertime buzz of the cicadas. It had been a long afternoon's drive after a night in Le Havre at a cheap hotel. First a late start because, of course, Eve was hungover. And then the hours of jolting along rutted French roads, stopping every hour or so for me to get out and throw up. I made excuses about motion sickness, but really it was the little problem. Or maybe it was just the thought of what was coming that made me queasy. I looked at the house again, and the shuttered windows looked like dead eyes.
Go on, then.
Finn pulled a tattered issue of the auto car from under his seat, leaning an elbow on the window to read.
When you get back, we'll head to Rouen and find a hotel.
Thank you. I turned my back on the gleaming blue Lagonda and headed up the drive. No one answered my knock. I knocked again. It took so long I was ready to start peering in windows, but at last I heard shuffling footsteps inside, and the door creaked open. Tante Jeanne, I began, before the sight of her froze me. My French aunt had always been slender, scented, blonde like Rose. An invalid, but the Greta Garbo kind. All pretty lace bed jackets and a delicate cough. The woman before me was horribly thin, gray-haired, dressed in a soiled sweater and a drab skirt. I could have passed her on the street and not recognized her. And from her blank look, she didn't know me either. I swallowed. Tante, it's Charlotte, your niece. I've come to ask you about Rose. She didn't offer me tea or biscuits, just sank into an old divan and regarded me blankly. I perched on the edge of a frayed armchair opposite. She lost everything, I thought, looking at the prematurely aged face in front of me. Widowed, 2 sons dead, Rose gone. I didn't know how Tante Jeanne was even still standing. I knew she loved my cousin, no matter what childish doubts Rose had carried. I'm so sorry, Tante. I began. For everything. She trailed a fingertip over the coffee table, leaving a mark in the dust. Dust lay everywhere like a mantle in the darkened room. War. Such a small, hopeless syllable to cover so much loss. Tears pricked my eyes, and I laced my gloved fingers together. Tante, there's nothing to be done about Oncle, or Jules or Pierre, but there's Rose. I know it's a slim chance, but she might be... alive. Eve had mocked me for hoping, but I had to hope. I might be a failure at a lot of things, but I was good at hope.
What do you think I know? She was in Limoges when I last heard from her,
my aunt stated as though that were the end of it.
She left off writing at least 3 years ago. Mid-44, I suppose.
Why did she leave here? I asked, trying to see a spark, a gleam, anything in my aunt's eyes. Why? My aunt's voice was low and bitter.
Because she was a little troublemaker with no morals. No morals at all.
The bottom fell out of my stomach.
What?
Tante Jeanne shrugged.
No.
I shook my head.
No, you don't just say that and then shrug. That girl went wild. Nazis all over Paris, and she wouldn't keep her head down. First it was sneaking out to listen to God knows what kind of speeches. Those clubs where fools talk violence, coming home at all hours of the night. the row she used to have with her father. The Germans wanted lists of all the socialists and Jews working for his company. What was he supposed to do? Refuse? The things all shouted at him.
I stared at my aunt, blood thundering my ears. She continued in her flat voice.
First she was putting pamphlets on cars, then she was breaking windows. She'd probably have gone on to blowing things up and getting herself shot if it hadn't been for the boy.
I remembered Rose's last letter to me. She was giddy about a boy she was seeing on the sly.
What boy? Etienne something. Just 19. A bookshop clerk. A nobody. She brought him to meet us once. They glowed when they looked at each other. You could tell they were...
A disapproving huff.
Well, that was another row.
I shook my head, numb to my fingertips. Why didn't you tell us any of this, when my father was making inquiries?
I did tell him. I suppose he thought it wasn't suitable for your ears.
I swallowed. What happened then?
Rose's boy got caught with the resistance. They shipped him off. Who knows where? Half of Paris was disappearing overnight. Rose probably would have, too. She'd already nearly been arrested for kicking a brown shirt on the Rue de Rivoli. So we brought her back here to Rouen. But...
What? I nearly screamed. What?
What do you think?
My aunt's lips pursed like she'd bitten a lemon.
Rose was pregnant.
I don't remember how I got to the beech tree outside the house. I just found myself leaning up against the rough bark, breath coming in hitching gasps. I was terrified to look up at the tree branch above my head, fearing I'd imagine two little girls side by side. This had been our tree, our refuge from our bullying brothers back in the days before James grew older and kinder. Rose and me, sitting on that branch now over my head, feet swinging, like we'd sat in that Provençal café. Never alone, as long as we had each other. Rose. Oh, Rose. I want to do something different. And she had it in her. Of course she'd be striding through the Paris nights, breaking windows and kicking brown shirts. I should have known Rose would get involved with the resistance. But she'd gotten caught in the oldest trap there is, just like me. Rose wasn't going to write a book or swim the channel or do anything different. Because once you're pregnant, you're finished. I'd wanted to save my cousin, but no one could save her from this. I was stuck in the same trap, helpless. I let out a single harsh sob, so loud it startled me. Had she sat out here all alone on our tree branch the night she told her parents, after her mother advised her to take a hot bath and have a stiff gin, and then see if she could dance it loose? After her father shouted and shouted, saying she'd brought shame on the family forever. Tante Jeanne had told me all of that as I sat staring. My father didn't shout at me when I told him. My mother did all the shouting. He just sat there gazing at me. When I left the room, he turned his head away and just said disbelievingly, "Whore." I'd forgotten that. I wondered if they'd called Rose a whore, too. I slammed my fists into the beech tree, wishing I could cry, wishing I could wrap myself in my old insulating numbness. But the tears were tied up tight inside me in a huge, ugly knot, and stabs of fury and pain cut me too deep for numbness. So I just hit the tree until my knuckles were stinging through my gloves. My eyes were hot and burning when I finally turned away. My aunt stood watching from the back door, frail and hunched. "Tell me the rest," I said. And she did, her voice flat. My uncle had sent Rose to a little town outside Limoges to give birth away from anyone she knew. She didn't write when the baby was born, told them nothing about it, and they didn't ask. 4 months later, Rose sent a brief note saying she was going to work in Limoges and would pay her parents back for every franc they'd spent on her confinement. Money had come, and two more sets of letters had been exchanged, announcement of first her father's death and then her brother's, and Rose's awkward, tear-splotched condolences. No, Tante Jeanne couldn't remember Rose's address. She hadn't saved the letters or the envelopes, and after mid-44, no more had come.
I don't know if she's still in Limoges, my aunt said, and paused. I asked her to come back, you know. Rose's father would never hear of it while he was alive. But after he... Well, I asked. She never answered me.
I didn't ask if Rose's baby had been included in that offer of hospitality. I was trembling too hard.
Are you staying the night?
Tante Jeanne sounded mournful.
It gets very lonely here.
Whose fault is that? I wanted to lash out. You're the one who threw Rose away like trash. You should have left her in that cafe in Provence. The words burned at my lips, aching to come out, but I bit them down. My aunt was so thin a breeze could blow her away, finally looking like the invalid she'd always claimed she was. A husband and two sons dead. She'd lost so much. Be kind. I didn't want to be kind, but at least I managed not to say the things I was thinking. I just said stiffly, No, Tante. I can't stay. I have to go to Roubaix. Tante Jeanne sighed. Well, then. I couldn't make myself hug her. I couldn't bear it. I jerked out a stiff goodbye and moved unsteadily across the weedy lawn, back to the dark blue shape of the Lagonda. Finn looked up from the autocar's tattered pages. I don't know what expression he saw on my face, but he sprang out of the car.
Miss.
Why'd you go to prison? I heard myself ask.
Stole a bearskin hat of a Buckingham Palace guard,
he said with no expression.
Are you all right?
You're lying about the hat.
Yes. Get in the car.
I moved toward the convertible, but tripped in the graveled path. Finn caught me around the waist before I could fall, lifted me up and helped me into the front seat. Eve was awake, regarding me with those hooded eagle eyes of hers.
Well?
I rubbed my hot cheek with a cold hand as Finn slid back behind the wheel. I found out why Rose left. Because she was pregnant. The silence was deafening.
Well,
Eve said at last, aiming a deliberate glance at my stomach.
Unless I miss my guess,
so are you. Chapter 8 Eve June 1915 Eve was brought up short not by any of Lille's various horrors, and there were certainly horrors, but by a poster. It was tacked outside a church, flapping in the breeze, and it said in both French and German, Any civilian, including the civilian staff of the French government, who helps troops who are enemies of Germany, or who acts in a way injurious to Germany and her allies, will be punished by death.
Oh, those.
Lily sounded matter-of-fact.
They went up late last year. I don't think anyone really believed them at first. Then in January a woman was shot for harboring two French soldiers, and that drove the point home nicely.
Eve remembered the recruitment poster she'd lingered in front of in London, watched all the while by Captain Cameron. The stalwart Tommies, the blank space in the middle. There is still a space available for you. Will you fill it? Well, she'd filled it. And now she was standing in front of a poster that promised to kill her if she was caught. And it had all become very, very real. More real than Captain Cameron's promise on a windy Folkestone beach that the Boche did not shoot women. Eve looked into Lily's sunken eyes and the mobile, smiling face.
We're in the mouth of the beast now, aren't we?
Yes.
Lily put her arm through Eve's, moving her away from the flapping poster. She looked very different here than she did in Le Havre. No outrageous hat or elaborate pompadour. She stood neat and subdued in a plain serge suit, her gloves mended and remended, a bag over her arm. Her papers, giving yet another false name, proclaimed her to be a seamstress, and her bag carried reels of thread and needles. It also carried a set of maps sewn into the lining, maps marked with target points. Thank goodness Eve didn't learn that until after they passed the checkpoints into Lille. She nearly fainted when Lily chuckled.
The Fritzies would have been pleased to find that lot. I've marked out all their new artillery positions for bombing.
You were making jokes with the German sentries as they were going over your papers. And all the while you had that in your bag.
Oui, Lily said serenely, and Eve stared at her in a mix of admiration and horror. She knew right then that her boasting to Captain Cameron about how she would surpass his prize agent was destined to be unfulfilled, because nobody ever would beat Lily when it came to sheer nerve. Eve both wondered if her superior was a little mad, and admired her violently. So clearly did Violette Lameron, who greeted them both in a dismal rented room somewhere off the Grand Place. Violette was sturdy and glowering, with neatly knotted hair and plain round spectacles. She hugged Lily with visible relief, even while scolding her.
You should have let me fetch the new girl. You make too many crossings, you're going to get noticed. Tais-toi, you warrior.
Lily switched into English, as she'd already told Eve they were to do when alone. Far better to spin a story about how they spoke English, if they were overheard, she explained, than to be understood discussing things like secret messages and British codes in French. Lily's English was flawless, but she salted it with casual French curses.
Now, we need to get Marguerite up to date before you and I head to the border to get the reports out.
She smiled at Violette.
Our new friend is splendidly dumb-faced, and she's going to be brilliant, but she needs work.
In Folkestone, Eve's training had been formalized. The instructors, the row of desks, the uniforms and flags. This training was quite different. It happened in a damp little room with a narrow bed and a single washstand, and a crack running through the ceiling, where everything smelled musty from the unending needle-fine rain falling outside. A room chosen not for its comfort, but its proof against eavesdropping, since on one side the building was insulated by the thick stone wall of a chapel, on the other side by a derelict and abandoned apartment building, and above them by an empty attic. A room where three women sat with mugs of an unappetizing drink made of walnut leaves, boiled with licorice, because the Germans had confiscated all the coffee, talking matter-of-factly about unspeakable things.
A German officer walks towards you on the street, Violette began, after the door and window were checked and sealed.
She looked grim compared to Lily's jauntiness. If her superior refused to be serious, she was clearly carrying the grimness for two.
What do you do?
Let him pass. Don't look at him.
Wrong. Salute. If you don't, you risk a fine and 3 days arrest.
Violette looked at Lily.
Do they teach them anything in Folkestone?
Eve bristled.
They teach us plenty.
We'll get her ready, Lily reassured her lieutenant.
A German asks to see your papers, then starts to grope you.
What do you do?
Nothing,
Eve guessed.
No, smile, because if you can't fake a smidge of willingness, you will likely get slapped and then possibly searched.
A German asks why you have your hands in your pockets.
What do you do?
Take them out as quickly as...
No. You don't put your hands in your pockets ever, because the Huns will think you are searching for a knife, and they will bayonet you.
Eve smiled uneasily.
Surely not.
Violette's hand cracked across her cheek, making a sound like a rifle shot.
You think we exaggerate? It happened to a boy of 14 last week.
Eve's hand flew to her stinging face. Her eyes turned to Lily, sitting with her little hands wrapped around her mug.
What? Lily said. You think we are here to be your friends? We are here to train you, little Daisy.
Anger flared through Eve. More than anger, betrayal. Lily had been so warm and welcoming in Le Havre. Now everything was wrong-footed.
I've already been trained.
Violette rolled her eyes.
I say send her back. This one is useless.
Eve opened her mouth to snap back, but Lily laid a finger over her lips.
Marguerite, she said, and her voice was matter-of-fact. You don't have any idea what it is like here. Neither does Uncle Edward. He gave you the training that would get you here. But Violette and I have to give you the training that will make you useful here. And keep you alive. We have just a few days to do it. If you don't learn, you're nothing but a liability.
Her gaze was steady and unapologetic. She could have been a factory foreman delivering a brisk lecture to a new worker. And Eve's cheeks burned with embarrassment.
She let out a slow breath, unclenched her jaw, and managed to nod.
Salute all German officers. Do not object to being groped. Keep my hands out of out of my pockets. What else?
They drilled her, over and over. Encounter drills. What do you do if? Quick hide drills. If they happen upon you before you've hidden a report, what do you do to distract and delay? And they tutored her about the new rules of life in Lille.
Trust nothing in the newspapers or bulletins. If it's in print, it's a lie, Lily decreed. Carry your identity cards at all times, but hide your pistol.
Violette had a Luger of her own, which she handled with casual authority.
Civilians aren't supposed to have weapons.
Steer clear of the German officers. They think they can have any of the women they want, with or without their consent. And once that happens, a good many people in Lille will despise you for a collaborator, and say you flopped on your back just to get favors. You'll live here, in this room. Before now, we've used it as a bolt hole for quick overnights. But now you'll live here, so the door outside will need a posted notice with your name and your age in case a roll is called. No gatherings of more than 10 people allowed.
How does anyone live like this?
Eve wondered on the second day, finally earning enough grudging approval to venture the occasional question.
Life is shit here, Lily said. It will likely go on being shit until we drive the Germans out.
When will I report to you? If I learn anything?
We come through regularly, Violette and I.
Lily grinned at her lieutenant.
We'll continue to bunk here with you when we need to stay the night in town. But we're on the move so much between all my drops. You'll be alone more often than not.
Violette looked at Eve with an utter lack of enthusiasm.
I hope you're up to it. Salope.
Lily tugged Violette's taut bun.
Don't be such a bitch.
German-run Lille was a horrible place, Eve soon saw. Before the war it must have been a fine, bright, bustling city. Church spires piercing the sky, pigeons fluttering about the Grand Place, street lamps casting circles of warm yellow light in the dusk. Now the city was dulled and wretched, every face downcast and pinched with hunger. They weren't far from the trenches, and soldiers and the real action of war. The boom of guns in the distance rolled like low thunder, and occasionally a biplane droned overhead like a poisonous wasp. The Huns had held Lille since last fall, thoroughly entrenched. The boulevards sported new street signs with German names, German boots rang confidently on the cobbles, and German chatter resounded loudly in every public place. The only pink, well-fed faces were German, and that alone was enough to push Eve very quickly from a rather impersonal dislike of the enemy to utter burning hatred.
"Don't get too much fire in your eye," Lily advised, helping Eve dress for her interview.
A neat, drab skirt and shirt waist. But it was more than just the clothes. Lily was dulling Eve's skin with a few strategic dabs of chalk and soot, downplaying the healthy color in her cheeks.
You need to look downcast and beaten, little Daisy. That's what the Germans want to see. Fire in the eye will get you looked at.
Downcast, Eve repeated grimly.
Oui.
Violette looked her over, round glasses flashing.
Her air gleams.
They dulled it with a little dirt. Eve rose, putting on her darned gloves.
I am a country girl, newly come from Roubaix, she recited. Desperate for work, badly educated, neat, deft, a little stupid.
You look stupid, Violette said matter-of-factly, and Eve glared. She didn't much like Violette, but there was no doubt she excelled at her job. Evelyn Gardner was gone. The room's single, badly polished mirror reflected dull-skinned, hungry-looking Marguerite Lefrançois. Eve looked at Marguerite, and performer's anxiety stabbed her like any actress preparing to step on stage.
What if I fail? What if Lulite's owner doesn't hire me? Then we send you home.
Lily wasn't unkind, merely blunt.
Because we can't use you anywhere else, little Daisy. So go lie your head off. Try to get hired. And try not to get shot.
If René Bordelon was a beast, he had a very elegant den.
That was Eve's first thought as she waited in Le Lete. Six girls, Eve included, had assembled along the linen-draped table.